Okay, so let us continue, and just to remind you, we have looking at these 37 Bodhipakya Dhammas. So far we have looked at four of these sets, seven sets altogether. We have looked at three sets of four, for our efforts, four mindfulness meditations, the four Iddhipadas, the four kind of spiritual powers, the five spiritual faculties. And the next set is another set of five called the five spiritual powers. And it's a very easy set because there is almost no information about it at all in the suttas. So it's just kind of seems to be almost like an alternative name for the five spiritual faculties. Five balas, pancha bala. And there is only one sutta that really talks about them in any kind of meaningful sense. And that sutta just uses a simile to show how the five balas compare to the five indriyas. And I haven't even mentioned the sutta here, it's not actually in here. And what the sutta says is that it's like a river. When you have a river flowing and there's an island in the middle of the river divides and goes on either side of the island, and then it merges after the island. And the either side of the island, one is five indriyas, the other side is the five balas. So it's almost as if it is two different angles from which to view pretty much the same thing, different names for the same thing, slightly different perspective perhaps, something like that. And one is a power, bala is a power, indriya is a faculty. So it is like an ability versus a power, maybe kind of slightly different mental functions and how they propel the mind forward on the path perhaps. It is a bit strange why there is one of these 37 is so little talked about in the suttas, why it is even included. It's a bit of a conundrum. I'm not really sure what the answer is to that. So it just doesn't really matter. Shrug your shoulders and kind of continue with the next set. That's kind of my idea with this. So that means that we have seen so far 22 out of 37. There's only two sets left to go, which fits well with the length of the retreat. And this is the seven factors of awakening, first of all, and then the Eightfold Path is the last one. 15 of these Bodhipakya Dhammas to go. We're going to have a look at the seven factors of awakening at a bit of length because they are interesting, and in particular they are interesting because they are like the opposite of the five hindrances. So very often when you read the suttas and you go to especially the Sambhujanga Sanghita, which is the connected discourses on the factors of awakening, when you go there, the suttas very often talk about both the seven factors of awakening and the five hindrances. And the reason for that is because as you reduce the hindrances, the bhujangas, the factors of awakening, arise. As you give rise to the factors of awakening, you overcome the hindrances. They are like the inverse of each other. That's why they're often used together in this particular way. So this is what we're going to have a look at. So we're going to first of all just look at the seven factors of awakening. First of all, the little sutta which just defines them and just mentions them, and then move on from there. So this sutta is SN 46.5, a monk, and 46 is the Bhujanga Sanghita, the 46th chapter of the Connected Discourses, sutta number 5. At Savati, then a mendicant went up to the Buddha and said to him, "Sir, they speak of awakening factors. How are the awakening factors defined? What are they?" Mendicant, "They are called awakening factors because they lead to awakening." A mendicant develops the awakening factor of mindfulness. They develop the awakening factor of investigation of principles. The awakening factor of energy, the awakening factor of rapture, the awakening factor of tranquility, the awakening factor of immersion, the awakening factor of equanimity, which rely on seclusion, fading away and cessation, and ripen as letting go. As they develop these seven awakening factors, their mind is freed from the defilement of sensuality. Freed from the defilement of desire to be reborn, and freed from ignorance. When they are freed, they know they are freed. They understand rebirth has ended. The spiritual journey has been completed. What had to be done has been done. There is no return to any state of existence. They are called awakening factors because they lead to awakening. So that is the first point about these awakening factors. They are the kind of final, if you like, the final push towards awakening among all these factors, and they are the development of samadhi is what they are about, and specifically how samadhi develops out of sati. That's why the sati sambhujanga is first, and there's different ways in which this is defined, and we'll have a look at that later on, and then how that eventually leads all the way to samadhi. And when you get to samadhi is always the cause for awakening. Vijja vimutti arises out of that samadhi. Especially the deeper the samadhi is, the more power it has for awakening. And that's why you have the four jhanas on the Noble Eightfold Path, because if you have all four, then the greatest possibility for awakening as a consequence. So this is an important point, because it is not obvious that they should mean that which leads to awakening. Sometimes they are understood as the factors that comprise the awakening experience, but that is not what they are meant to be. They're actually meant as the things that lead to awakening. So sometimes you may wonder why I'm saying these things, but unless you have taken part in discussions in Dhamma, you may not know that of all the alternative views that sometimes arise. And this is so these are kind of pointers to point you in the right direction, the meaning of these things. So just briefly, let's have another look at these awakening factors, because it's useful to know how they work. And it is probably quite familiar to you by now, this sequence that you see here, especially the sequence from mindfulness, energy, rapture, tranquility, and samadhi immersion. This sequence is so common in the suttas. We just saw a very similar sequence this morning when we had a look at how to use faith to give rise to very similar qualities. There too you had rapture, immersion, and energy was kind of implied by some of the other things there, we're talking about inspiration, for example. So it is a very similar sequence that you see in so many different places, taught in slightly different ways to bring out slightly different aspects of the same sequence. You have a famous sequence known as dependent liberation, which is a very similar kind of thing, also very closely related to these bhojangas. So from that, you know that this is one of those kind of really core principles of awakening when the Buddha talks about this. So it's really worthy of quite a bit of a study and understanding, because it is found everywhere pretty much. And it starts off with the awakening factor of mindfulness. And this is very often understood as the four satipatthana practices. In other words, any satipatthana practice you do, and I would say, as usual, especially mindfulness of breathing, but any satipatthana practice, because satipatthana is what drives you towards samadhi. It is always the factor that leads you to samadhi, according to the suttas. So this is one way of looking at this, and then you kind of develop these things, and then the investigation of principles, that is very closely related to the fourth satipatthana, the Dhammanupassana, because investigation of principles here means really just understanding what is wholesome, what is unwholesome, what is blameworthy, what is blameless, what is dark, what is bright. In other words, understanding those aspects of the mind that lead you forward and those aspects that hold you back, which is exactly the same thing you find in the fourth satipatthana, which is all about the five hindrances and the bhujangas. Yeah, the bhujangas are actually included within the fourth satipatthana, the understanding of the bhujangas. So it's all kind of very interrelated and interconnected. So it's almost impossible to untangle this from each other. Actually, it is impossible. It's all a big spaghetti mess of teachings kind of tangled up. And so this is what you see here, very closely related to that. So the first two factors here, one way of regarding them is as satipatthana practice, all four of them. Another way of looking at this first one is to understand the sati sambhujanga as contemplation of Dhamma teachings. Yeah, you hear a good Dhamma teaching, we'll see this later on, and you listen to it, and this is what we're kind of trying to do, at least in part on this retreat. And then from that, from listening to the Dhamma, investigating that Dhamma teaching, and then these other bhujangas arising from that. So this is another way of thinking about the first bhujanga. In the investigating that teaching, then becomes Dhammavicaya, the second one, and then things kind of carry on. In fact, any contemplation that gives rise to mindfulness, including things we have been looking at just before, the Buddha Anusati, the Sangha Anusati, or any one of these things that lead to mindfulness arising, can be, I think, included in the Sati Sambhojanga. Because it gives rise, it starts this sequence, it gets this sequence going. Because the bhujangas are also sequential, one leading to the next one. They cause each other. There's a causal sequence going on here as well. So that is how the first two are usually looked at. And we'll look at this a little bit more later on, but for now we can leave it at that. And then as you investigate these states of mind and the defilements, you understand what they are, that enables you to abandon those things. You have to investigate them to be able to abandon them, and as they become abandoned, the natural energy and mindfulness and pamudja, the joy of the mind, comes out of that. It arises pretty much automatically, because the less defilements you have, the more joy will automatically be there, and the energy will be there. So the energy arises, this matrix of mindfulness, energy, and pamudja, the kind of basic joy that comes on the path, comes out of that investigation, overcoming of problematic states. And then with that energy, rapture comes, the increased joy, and now you are really on the meditation path. All of this is really, in one way, part of Satipatthana as well, because everything that leads up to samadhi is really part of Satipatthana practice. So it's all a little bit kind of intermixed. But more and more refined Satipatthana as you go along. The tranquility comes from the rapture. When the rapture dies down, we've seen this before, and then when the tranquility becomes really profound, you experience this beautiful peace and happiness. That is where immersion and samadhi takes place. And then you develop that immersion, you develop that samadhi to that as deeply as you can, eventually taking it all the way to the equanimity, which really here signifies the fourth jhana. And that is the springboard for all the insights you can possibly ever want. When you get to the fourth jhana, the mind reaches its maximum power and stability. This point is called imperturbable. Imperturbable means it cannot be moved by the worldly things, by the world around you. It is completely steady. And because it is so imperturbable, it means that you can kind of take even insights that might be difficult for others to take because they are so powerful. It can really shock you when you have the imperturbable mind. You can deal with all of these things. That is why the fourth jhana is the ultimate springboard for awakening, if you wish. So that is the seven factors of awakening, and as always, they are rely on seclusion, fading away, and cessation. These things all show you again the importance of a degree of solitude. Yeah, you have to have that solitude there. This is how meditation almost always is described in the suttas. It relies on that solitude, the seclusion, and then it also relies on the gradual fading away and cessation of your experienced world. Your experienced world, whatever it is that we experience, becomes simpler and simpler and simpler. More and more things fading away. More and more still, more and more unified. Less and less things happen until there's hardly anything left at all. And that is the foundation required for these things to really work. And eventually it ripens in letting go. And that is really kind of the idea of awakening here. Yeah, and then you get this result, and this is kind of the very end of the path. The result is the mind is freed from sensuality, from all desire for sensory experience. You still experience things in the sensory world, but you don't desire anymore because you realize it is an inferior and corrupted kind of happiness that always leads to problems. So you don't desire in the world. You still live in that world, but you have no desire for it. No desire to get reborn, This is the bhava-sava. It literally means no desire for existence. Yeah, you don't really care about existing anymore. It's kind of a strange state of mind, isn't it? Not to care about existence. If somebody says, I'm going to kill you, you just shrug your shoulders. That's kind of the not having no desire for existence. And then the last one is the avijja-asava, the asava, the corruption or defilement of mind that has to do with delusion. No more delusion. Delusion has been completely undermined. These three asavas are quite important. These are, if you like, the root defilements. And once they have been taken out, then you are freed. And when you are freed, you know you are freed. If you're an arahant, you know you're an arahant. If you're not sure, if you think you might be an arahant, but you're not sure, you're not an arahant. And then you know that rebirth is ended. This is interesting, isn't it? This is what the arahant understands. They understand rebirth is ended. And then the last one is the no return to any state of existence. Both of those have to do with rebirth. Yeah, so basically what the arahant knows, the ending of dukkha, that is what they know. Ending of suffering is all about the ending of rebirth. And the other things here are, don't say quite as much. The spiritual journey has been completed, okay? It doesn't really say anything specifically about that insight. It just says that you know you have reached it. And what had to be done has been done. Similar kind of thing. The main importance there is the idea of rebirth having been ended. That is the one that really says something about your insight. Even though you haven't come to the end of your life, you know you're not going to be reborn again. So they are called the factors of awakening because they lead to awakening. So there you are. So that is where these awakening factors are heading, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about them later on. But for now, I'm going to turn to the five hindrances, because these are such important aspects of the path, and I'm going to talk quite a lot about these, because there are some really nice suttas about them, and some of you have been asking before to kind of to fill in a little bit on some of these things, and that is what I expect to do today now, this afternoon, and also tomorrow as well, because it's going to take a while to get through these things, and they're really, I think it's really worthwhile spending a bit of time on this. These are really core aspects of the Buddhist path. So this next sutta is also from the Bodhjanga Sangyutta, 46th chapter of the Connected Discourses. Second sutta is called the Body. And it starts out with the five hindrances. At Savati, mendicants, this body is sustained by food. It depends on food to continue, and without food it doesn't continue. In the same way, the five hindrances are sustained by fuel. They depend on fuel to continue, and without fuel they don't continue. The word for food here and fuel is the same word. It is ahara. Ahara means like nutriment. And nutriment is quite nice because it almost bridges those two words. Yeah, in English you translate as food in one, and the other one you translate as fuel. But ahara, nutriment, kind of bridges the idea of fuel and food here. So the body is sustained by food. How is the body sustained by food? Well, if you are young, you need food to grow. Yeah, if you don't get enough food, you stop growing and things, etc., etc. And when you are fully grown, you still need food to sustain life. It is for two things that you need nutriment. You need nutriment to increase, to grow, and you also need nutriment to stay alive. And this is an exact parallel to the five hindrances. The five hindrances, if you give them the wrong kind of nutriment, or the right, depending on what you want to do, say the wrong one, they will increase. And not only, so that is one of them. You keep on putting in the wrong nutriment, the desire and the aversion, they just increase and increase, can get worse and worse by fueling them in the wrong way. But they also need that fuel just to stay alive. If you subtract the nutriment from the five hindrances, if you stop fueling them altogether, they will actually die down. And this is one of the things about meditation practice. If you watch the breath, you are no longer fueling any of these defilements. Because watching the breath is not a fuel for the defilements. So if you keep watching the breath, actually you are starving the defilements of their support, of their nutriment. And this is one way that the meditation actually works. Because you are no longer supporting the five hindrances, they actually gradually die down simply by the fact that you are watching the breath. Sometimes it only takes you so far, because sometimes the attachments are very deep-seated, so you become calm to a certain level, you get rid of the defilements to a certain level, then it doesn't go any further. And so then you may need to be more actively invested in overcoming the defilements. But to a large extent, they just die away simply by the fact that you are watching the breath. And sometimes the mind rebels. The mind says, no, I don't want to watch the breath. And sometimes that's simply because maybe the mind is feeling a bit afraid. It's kind of losing these kind of desires in the world. And the mind kind of freaks out a little bit. Because this is you. This is me. I live in this world. This is part of who you are, enjoying this world. And then your very sense of self is undermined when things become too peaceful and still. You're kind of feeling on shaky ground. You're outside of your comfort zone. This is scary stuff. And it is scary. It is scary because we have so many attachments, because our sense of self is quite deep. Sometimes simple little things can be scary to people. People sit in meditation, they can't feel their hand anymore. And they kind of freak out a little because they can't feel their hand, or they can't feel their body, or they can, simple things like that, because you're so used to having them around, can sometimes make people afraid. But of course, it's nothing to be afraid of. In fact, it's the exact opposite. We are clinging on to suffering here. Thinking that we're clinging on to something useful, all we're holding on to is suffering here. This is the Buddha's perspective on this. So this is then gives you the framework for how this works, this whole idea of abandoning the fuel for the hindrances. So the first one, first hindrance, what fuels the arising of sensual desire, and when it has arisen, makes it increase and grow. There is the feature of beauty. Frequent improper attention to that fuels the arising of sensual desire, and when it has arisen, makes it increase and grow. Sensual desire here, first of all, it means desire in the realm of the five senses. It's important to understand what this means. Kama chanda, sensual desire makes it sound like a very narrow kind of desire, but actually it is incredibly broad. It includes everything in the realm of the five senses. So what is it that gives rise to this desire? It is the feature of the beauty. When you see something as beautiful in the realm of the five senses, you like it, you want it, you want to attach to it, you want to hold on to it. This is kind of how we work as human beings. And a large part of this particular hindrance is abandoned at the early stages of the path. We have looked before at the idea of sense restraint and sampajanya, the idea of clear comprehension of things. And a lot of this is abandoned early on. When we come to the meditation here, the bhujangas, we're talking about fairly refined manifestations of these hindrances, not the coarse ones. They had to go early on in the path. This is the refined stuff. So because it is refined stuff, it is also much more difficult to see what is going on, what is actually happening here. Very often these things are simply manifestations of the fact that we enjoy seeing in general, we enjoy hearing. It's not nice to be blind. But on the Buddhist path, it's almost like you have to allow yourself to become blind. That's scary for most people, because that's exactly what we try our entire lives to avoid. We go to the doctor so we can see well, we have operations so we put ear implants so we can hear properly, we do all these things so that we can still be part of the world. So giving these things up can be a little bit scary. It isn't, but it can feel that way as you go through this. So we see the beauty simply, of course, in the objects of the world, but in a more profound sense, in the very ability to see. We see a sense of beauty, we see something good, we see something that we want. In our ability to access the body, so we can still feel the body, we see something beautiful and something useful by having access to feeling the body. So the idea here is gradually to overcome that whole realm of the five senses, gradually giving up these senses altogether. And that is what is so interesting about deep states of samadhi. You lose access to these five senses. It is as if you are accepting that you go blind. When you enter those states, you don't really know whether you're going to get those states back again. Yeah, you enter a state of jhana, you don't know whether the senses are going to come back again. Of course they do, because that is kind of how it works, but you don't really know that. You enter it, it's kind of, it takes a leap of faith to do that, because now all of these things have to be left behind completely. You can't access them anymore. You don't know whether they're going to come back. And this is why it can be a bit kind of, you're getting outside of your comfort zone when the samadhi becomes incredibly deep. And this is the problem. So you need, for that reason, you need to contemplate these things. Instead of always thinking about sight and hearing being something that is attractive and useful and something we should hold on to, you understand the problems in that world. You understand how disturbing it is. In one sense, you can understand it in some ways quite easily, because as soon as you close your eyes, you are actually taking away a large amount of disturbance in the meditation. You can feel that, the sense of sight is very, there's so much input, there's so much data coming into your mind all the time through the eyes. It actually, just closing your eyes sometimes, when you feel tired, yeah, what do? You often just naturally close your eyes because you don't want all that data anymore. You just want to be quiet inside. And this is gives you some indication of the disturbance of the five senses right there. Also, noise is generally disturbing. Most people love to be, at least for a while, in quiet places, because there's something very beautiful about being in a quiet and peaceful place. It is not that hard to see that noise is also very disturbing and problematic. So you start contemplating that world in that way. The body, yeah, very obviously, it's so difficult. It always gives you lots of heaps of problems, the physical body. Just try sitting still for 1 hour and you know straight away how much problems there is in this body. So understanding these things, understanding the limitation of these things, understanding that the alternative, the happiness through meditation, is so much more profound. Gradually you overcome that seeing the beauty in these things, in the five senses. Gradually you see the problem in these things, that they are impermanent, that they supply so much suffering, so much dissatisfaction. And that they are really, in the end, they are completely out of control. And as you do that, you withdraw your investment in those five senses. And instead, you move towards the mental sense instead. So this is how it happens, gradually. It happens through seeing the meditation going well and through contemplating a little bit of the problem in the five senses. And then you head in that direction. This word here that is called beautiful, this is the subha nimittang, the characteristic of beauty, the feature of beauty, he calls it here. And the point is that this is a feature. It is not something inherent in the object. Beauty is not inherent in anything. It depends on how we look at it. Any object can be looked at as beautiful, or it can be looked at as not beautiful, depending on how we focus on it. And so this is kind of the thing. Nothing is inherently one way or the other. And this is why we can play with our perceptions and we can learn to see things differently. And the best way to see things is the way that leads you forward on the path to access deeper states of happiness. That is why it is useful to remember the downside of the sensory world. There's also another thing about this word subha. The word subha, beautiful, as so often in Buddhism, these words can be both positive and negative depending on the context. So subha, when it comes to the five senses, it is negative because it ties us to that world and it makes us a slave to that world of the five senses. But if seeing subha, seeing the beautiful in things that have to do with the Dhamma, have to do with meditation practice, and especially the Buddha talks about subhang adimutto, which means focusing on the beautiful, that actually refers to like loving-kindness meditation. You take loving-kindness meditation to a, a, a,
a very deep level, that's where you become subhang adimutto, focusing on the beautiful. So beauty is okay, but you have to see beauty in the right place. Seeing beauty in the good qualities in other people, seeing beauty that leads to metta, leads to compassion, all of these things, that is where it should be placed. Not seeing beauty in the five sense world. So it's always about choosing the right thing. Things are not absolute. Beauty isn't always wrong, but finding the right kind of beauty is what matters here. So this is how this works. So it says then, frequent improper attention. Yeah, improper attention is the ayoniso manasikara. So if you pay improper attention, it means you're always looking for the beautiful in things around you, in the five sense world. If you always look for the beautiful, always focus on that, you're going to grow your desires, grow your craving, grow your attachments, and sensual desire becomes strong, and it settles in you, and it gets hard to get rid of afterwards. The proper attention is the opposite. It's the reminder of the disadvantages of that sense world. And then as you do that, the fuel gradually decreases and decreases and decreases. And then the sensual desire itself also decreases. So that is how sensual desire arises and how it manifests and how you can overcome it. And tomorrow we're going to have to look at this in even more detail because it is such a interesting, fascinating area, and quite hard to see because we tend to think that enjoyment in that world is kind of unproblematic. We're just enjoying ourselves, just happy. But of course, it is not how it works from the Buddhist perspective. Let's go to the next one. Second hindrance, what fuels the arising of ill will, or when it has arisen, makes it grow and increase? There is the feature of harshness. Frequent improper attention to that fuels the arising of ill will, or when it has arisen, makes it increase and grow. And this harshness is what I mentioned the other day. It's the patiga nimitta. And the other time, what did I call it again? Impingement or something like that. Impingement is one way of looking at it. Resistance is another way. Yeah? So these are different ways of looking at this word patiga. So it something that you resist, yeah, or impinges on you in a negative way. Yeah. And here, the harshness is how he translates it here. I'm not sure how Bandhusajata has got to come up with the word harshness, but it kind of makes sense. The idea here is that you focus on the negative aspect of something. Yeah. Yeah, and as you focus on the negative aspect of something, then it becomes problematic, and eventually it can lead to ill will. Again, just like with the subha nimitta, we saw before with sensual desire, this is like often a secondary derivation. Because we enjoy the sensual world, then when the sensual world does not give us the objects that we desire, and they give us the painful objects, then this patiga nimitta arises. And we feel resistance to it, we feel the harshness of that world, and then ill will can often come up in the train. So it is these things are very closely related to each other, ill will and the world of the five senses. It is impossible to live in that world in the five senses, to have craving for it, to be attached to it, and not have ill will, basically. Anger, ill will, violence even, competition, competitiveness, all of these kind of negative qualities in the world, they arise ultimately out of the sensual realm. It's kind of scary, isn't it? Is it possible to really enjoy that sensual realm completely without some degree of conflict and problems and ill will in the world? It's very off-putting. Once you see that, and I will talk more about this tomorrow, once you start to see that, you get really put off that world. So the most basic of these five hindrances is actually the first one, the kama chanda. That is the one that drives pretty much all the other hindrances. That is the root problem. And that is why we saw earlier the defilements of sensuality and existence and ignorance, why that sensuality is singled out from the other hindrances, because it is the root problem that drives the other ones. If you had no sensuality, ill will wouldn't be a problem. And this is true also of the other remaining hindrances as well. They are to a large part the result of the first two, and especially the first hindrance. We have the tiredness, dullness and drowsiness. It comes from exerting yourself too much in that five-sense world, or it comes from anger and ill will. You get tired afterwards. The restlessness obviously comes from that world, because you are agitated and you're seeking these things and you're craving for them. That makes you restless almost by definition. You want to move in that world. And the doubt also is large part, comes also to a large extent from that world. Once you overcome the hindrances and you go into the jhanas, doubt is gone. And that is because it is connected with the world of the five senses. And also because when you get to the jhana states, well, you know what is wholesome and what is unwholesome in a different way than you knew before. So it's all connected to these things. And what that means is that to a very large extent, when we talk about overcoming the five hindrances, it is the first two that you need to focus on. Very often people ask, how do you overcome restlessness of the mind? How do you overcome the tiredness and all of these things? And initially, when you come on a retreat, it can be that you're just exhausted from all the hard work. But if these qualities remain in the mind afterwards, it is very often has to do with the fact that the mind is still attached to the sensual world. And because it is attached to that, and maybe when you're here, you don't get your fill of those pleasures in the same way you used to, perhaps. Or because the mind holds out there when you meditate, you don't have those pleasures, the mind just becomes dull. There's no energy, there is no interest, because that which you enjoy has been taken away from you. So that's why there is a gradual substitution. You let go of the sensory world or the attachment to it, and as you let go of that, the spiritual world or the spiritual happiness starts to arise. It's a gradual movement, substituting one for the other. So focus on the first two ones. They are the main problem. Don't worry so much about the last three. Maybe a doubt you can worry a little bit about, and I'll talk about that in a second, but the first two ones are by far the most important ones. And over the first two ones, I would really recommend you to focus most on the ill will aspect, because that is the most destructive one, and then to a lesser degree on the sensory world as a general object of attention. Ill will. So when you frequently give attention to the sign of that which is you resist and that which is harsh, ill will can arise. And again, it is very similar as with sensual desire, is that the way to overcome this is to look at the object in a different way. It is not to turn away from the object. Ill will very often has to do with other people. It is not to turn away from the other people. It is to learn to look at them in a new way. And this is, I'm going to talk about this quite a little bit more tomorrow, because this is a very, very important part of the spiritual path, understanding how to look at other people. It's kind of amazing. It is a shift in a perception, a shift in the way you think about something makes a massive difference in how you react to that person. It's possible on the spiritual path to basically almost never get angry with other people. Why? Because of this shift in perception that you've had inside. So very, very useful. And that is how then you overcome the ill will, simply by perceiving differently. So that is the ill will. Let's look at the last three hindrances. As I said, they mostly arise from the first two, but sometimes, especially as you come very close to the deep samadhi, they kind of almost take on a life of their own. And dullness, you can be a little bit dull, a tiny bit dull, and that can stop you from kind of gaining the full samadhi. So it still can be useful to be aware of what these things are. So what fuels the arising of dullness and drowsiness, or when it has arisen, makes it increase and grow? There is discontent, sloth, yawning, sleepiness after eating, and mental sluggishness. Frequent improper attention to them fuels the arising of dullness and drowsiness. When it has arisen, makes it increase and grow. Right, so yawning is not so good according to this. So it's interesting that yawning is in there. So you can see that in this case it is quite broad as well in kind of taking in into account a number of different things. So here we have two different words, dullness and drowsiness. And what is the difference between the two? One of them, tinna middha, the middha part, means basically the drowsiness you have after eating, for example. And it's very natural for the mind to be a bit drowsy after you have eaten. Whereas dullness is more a general dullness. The mind just dulls out. You don't want to be there anymore. And whatever it is, that's where that dullness. So that's two slightly different things. And the drowsiness after the meal and the tiredness that comes at night, some of these things you can only overcome so much. Yeah, even the Buddha is supposed to have slept a little bit after the meal, especially in the hot season. So these are natural physical things that happen with the body, and you can't avoid that. Sleep is required to some extent. You can't live without sleep. So this is more like the dullness that can be overcome, the dullness that you have when you shouldn't really be dull. Yeah, there's no real reason for it. You had a good night's sleep and you still feel dull when you wake up, that kind of stuff. So this is what is meant by this. So what is the improper attention to the dullness? And the improper attention here is simply, as I mentioned before, like either an enjoyment of dullness, or it can be that you don't enjoy your life. You have some dukkha going on in your life, and sometimes when you have some dukkha, some suffering in your life, you want to just be dull because you don't want to be there to experience all the dukkha in the world. So it is, you look upon this as a kind of suffering, a kind of happiness, and that's why you go into the dullness and drowsiness. So you start to see that. You start to see that that is a problem. It doesn't really lead you anywhere. If you're going to overcome problems, it's much better to have that sharpness. You may feel the pain a bit more acutely for a while, but it also gives the opportunity to overcome that pain in the long run. According to the Dhamma, there's number of ways that people overcome suffering. One is the escape into sensuality. This is often why we enjoy sensual pleasures, because we want to escape from the suffering of the world, and we don't know of any other escape apart from sensual pleasures. Or being dull. Dullness is another of these escapes. You just want to go to bed, you want to sleep, you had enough of the world, you want to just kind of blank everything out, and sometimes that happens as well. Whereas for the Aryas, the noble ones, the place to get rid of suffering is to just close your eyes, go into meditation, and just kind of go away from that world which is so out of control. So this is really how you deal with this. You see the problem, you don't enjoy, you try to avoid that enjoyment, you try to find other ways of dealing with suffering in life. Yeah, if you're going into sloth and torpor, it's a bit like taking a drug, isn't it? You take a drug because you just want to kind of wipe everything out. But taking drugs, we know that that isn't such a good idea. So same thing with tiredness also. It is not such a good idea because you don't really doesn't give you a chance to deal with these things. Then we have the restlessness and remorse. And in large part that is connected with craving. It's also connected with not keeping your sila properly. If you don't keep your sila properly, the mind becomes restless. The mind becomes not still, because the present moment is no longer pleasant. So you want to fantasize instead, you want to do other things. Or it can just be the craving of that world. And as I mentioned the other day, the fact that we identify with the doer. Yeah, I want to do, I am the doer, I love to kind of be the agent in my life, the creative aspect. It is kind of often, being creative is often kind of, you know, put people on a pedestal who are creative, artists and filmmakers and these kind of things, regardless of how miserable lives they often have. And some of these artists have such miserable life. Sometimes I feel it's terrible. You see how kind of some of these artists are feted in the newspapers and being, wow, they are, look at that creativity. And then when you look at their life, it's a complete mess. And they end up committing suicide and all kind of bad things. Yeah? Some of the most famous artists in the world have been some of the most absolutely miserable people in existence. And somehow we put them on a pedestal. It's kind of weird, isn't it? They haven't got a clue about how to live right. Maybe they kind of make other people happy through their art, but they can't live their own life. And somehow we put that on a pedestal. You have to be careful with these things, because we are building up and something which actually sometimes is not very positive at all, which actually have negative consequences. So creativity, yeah, we kind of look up to creativity, and that is part of the doing. Doing is a very important aspect. And even some of the highest realms in samsara are the realms of creation. The nimitta rati realm, which is one of the highest realms, the ones that delight in creation. Yeah? Creativity is always a very considered a very kind of positive thing. So, but in meditation terms, it is considered a hindrance, especially as you come very close towards samadhi. You have to give up your creative side and become still and peaceful instead. And of course, you find something even higher when you do that. That's kind of the point. So if, as long as we attach to being creative, as long as we attach to being doers, people who get things done and sort out problems, it's going to be hard to become completely still and content. So give up some of that attachment to doing. Allow instead the stillness to become your main identity. And if you identify with stillness rather than doing, you're going to go far deeper on this path of meditation. Know where to identify before you give up identity altogether at the very end of the path. So another word that is found in the suttas that relate to this is the idea of being a slave to craving. It's one of those inverses of how we normally think about the world. This idea of tanha dasa is found in the Ratapala Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya number 82. And it is this beautiful story, a beautiful sutta on Ratapala, the young man who goes forth, and he's the one foremost in faith and confidence in the Buddha's teachings. And then he meets this king, and he has a conversation with the king. And he says to the king, "The world is a slave to craving." And the king says, "What are you talking about? Don't understand anything what you're saying. What are you talking about?" And then he explains how we always are seeking for more. We're always driven by this desire inside of us. It feels like craving is our servant. Yeah, craving is there to make us happy. We crave so we can go out into the world and get the things that we need or whatever. But actually, it's the other way around. Craving is in charge, and we are being pushed around by craving, pushed around by restlessness. Craving is the master. Craving is whipping you over the back, says, "Run faster. Yeah, the goal is in sight. Go for it." And then you never get the goal. You never get there. And then you cry and you beat your breast and you weep because it was all within sight. You worked so hard for it. You were craving for it. And it didn't come. And then the government takes it away in taxes or whatever it is, that burglars rob it, or you drive that Ferrari into the tree. And and this is the problem. And then you cry and weep your breast and everything is taken away from you. And so that we crave, and the craving is actually restlessness. It's actually painful. But because we identify with doing, we think that it is happy. And this is kind of the problems with all of this. So again, see the dangers. And as you see them, you start to withdraw your interest in these things. And then the restlessness, the remorse, all of these things come gradually falling away. The last hindrance. What fuels the arising of doubt, or when it has arisen, makes it increase and grow? There are things that are grounds for doubt. Frequent improper attention to them fuels the arising of doubt, or when it has arisen, makes it increase and grow. So, doubt here. Doubt is not always bad. It is good sometimes to doubt. It is good to have doubt about something that is bad in this. If you, for example, a classical thing would be if someone does something bad, like maybe a spiritual teacher, it's good to have doubt about their attainments or their abilities to be a good teacher. Sometimes doubt is good. There are things that are grounds, good grounds for doubt in this world. What this refers to here, it refers to you have doubt about kusalesu, dhammesu, wholesome things. And dhamma can often mean two things in the suttas. Either it can mean the qualities inside of you, so it can mean that you have doubt about what is wholesome and what is unwholesome. Yeah, so you come in your meditation, you don't know what to do next. What do I do now? Don't know. It all seems to come to an end. I can't see any hindrances. Why am I stopping? So you don't really fully have full understanding of what is unwholesome and unwholesome. And that is an important thing to clear up. And this is what large part what meditation practice is about. It's about clearing out what is wholesome and what is unwholesome, to clear the path of those weeds so you can carry on all the way. But it can also refer to teachings. Dhamma also means teachings. So it means that you don't know what are good and bad teachings. Yeah, you don't know whether you should be a Buddhist or whether you should be a worship Thor and Odin. Yeah, that's what my ancestors worshipped, and I gave that up a long time ago. But actually, I quite like the idea of worshipping Thor and Odin, actually. If I wasn't a Buddhist, I might worship Thor and Odin instead. I'm not sure. There's something nice about Thor. There's not something nice about these gods. Yeah, and I don't know. All cultures have this large number of gods. You know, the Indian culture has lots of gods. You go to Chinese culture, have all these gods. If you go to ancient Greek culture, they have the gods. The Romans had their gods. The Egyptians had their gods. The Vikings and the ancient Nordics, they had their gods. Everyone has all these gods and lots of gods. Yeah, gods for this, gods for that. You pray to this god, this happens. You pray to that god, that happens. Actually, nothing happens in either case, but that's kind of the idea. So it's interesting, why is it that all of these cultures have gods in them? Why is that? Is it because we human beings are all the same, we're all utterly deluded and we believe in these things? That's one possibility. Yeah, we all kind of have similar kind of desires. We want to control the world, so we believe in the gods and we ask the gods for favors, and this way we can control the weather, make sure we have harvests and we don't have problems and the illnesses don't kind of sweep through the population and decimate it with the Black Death and all that kind of stuff. That is one reason. But I wonder sometimes whether that idea, because all ancient cultures seem to have the idea of gods, I wonder whether actually we are tapping into some kind of underlying reality here, that we actually are seeing something that actually is there, and then we interpret it in our own way depending on the culture. And that's why the ancient Indian gods are a bit different from the Greek ones or the Nordic ones. Yeah, they're all a bit different because the culture is different. But it's actually tapping into an underlying reality, the idea that there are other realms of existence. I think that is quite a possible way of looking at this idea of gods. And to me, it's a strange thing to say, but to me, this idea of multiple gods that do many things is actually more persuasive than the modern ideas of a single god that you have in the monotheistic religions around the world, one god that created the universe and that is there. To me, that is actually less realistic than the kind of, the Odin and Thor. That's what I'm saying. I wasn't just joking, yeah? I was quite serious. Actually, Odin and Thor, if I wasn't a Buddhist, I might believe in Odin and Thor instead. So I was completely serious about that. So it's strange, yeah? It's kind of funny because you start to look at the world in a different way once you kind of accept Buddhist ideas. I apologize. I hope I don't really want to offend anyone who is Christian. Maybe sometimes I go a bit too far in what I say, but this is how I'm just being honest about how I feel about these things, and that is kind of my outlook on this. Anyway, sidetracked. So the point is that there are teachings in this world that are useful. There are teachings that are not so good. I would not really recommend you to believe in Thor and Odin. The idea is just to fight and drink and that kind of stuff. You go to Valhalla, you go to the kind of the heaven of the Nordic gods, and all you do is continue your fighting and drinking. Yeah, they weren't so interested in women. Women weren't so important. As long as they could fight and drink, they were happy. It's a very strange kind of godly existence. So I wouldn't so forget about what I said. The idea here is to be able to distinguish between good and bad teachings. And this obviously is very, very important. And as long as we are confused and uncertain about that, you don't really have a spiritual path. And when you haven't got the spiritual path, you are fumbling around in darkness, not really knowing what you're doing here. So that is the problem there. Let us have a very quick look at these similes that explain this. They're actually quite quick and easy to understand. This is from the middle-length sayings of the Buddha, and these are similes that explain the five hindrances. Because suppose a person were to take out a loan and undertake business, and his business were to succeed so that he would repay all the money of the old loan and there would remain enough extra to maintain a wife. Then on considering this, he would be glad and full of joy. So this is the simile for sensual pleasures of the world. It's like taking out a loan. It always has to be repaid later on. You get your sensual objects, and before you know it, the sensual objects get taken away from you, either before you die or at least when you die. And usually, because you take a loan, you have to pay with interest. Yeah, all loans have interest, except maybe in Islam. In Islam, you're not supposed to have any interest, isn't that right? So you maybe except for Islam, but usually you have to pay interest when loans. And this was certainly the case in ancient India, because interest is mentioned in the early suttas. This is an ancient concept. It goes back 2,500 years. The bankers were already kind of getting their act together 2,500 years ago, knowing how to exploit people a little bit. So you always pay it back with interest. That's the nature of loans, because obviously the banker has to make some money. And this is the problem with sensual pleasures. You attach, and then it gets taken away, and then you grieve and you lament as part of that whole process. Or suppose a man were afflicted, suffering, and gravely ill, and his food would not agree with him, and his body had no strength. But later he would recover from the affliction, and his food would agree with him, and his body would regain its strength. Then on considering this, he would be glad and full of joy. Ill will is like an affliction. Yeah, you are afflicted, just like when you are ill, you makes you feel really bad. And that feeling of ill will is a kind of turmoil and madness. Actually, sometimes you get clarity as well when you're ill will, but it's a kind of bad clarity. And it feels very bad compared to the idea of metta, which is the exact opposite. It kind of makes you, it gives you into your small, narrow little world, and the world outside seems hostile and bad. So it is an affliction. It's also an affliction in the sense that it distorts your perceptions, just like illness can distort your perceptions when you have a fever or whatever. And then whenever you come out and you understand what these hindrances are and you have left them behind, you feel joy and gladness by the fact that you have left them behind, because you understand how problematic they are. Or suppose a man were imprisoned in a prison house, but later he would be released from that prison safe and secure with no loss of property. Then on considering this, he would be glad and full of joy. Dullness and drowsiness is like being imprisoned. You are stuck in this state, you can't get out, and you don't know how to get out, you just have to wait for the state to lift. And you lack clarity and you lack ability to operate properly when you are full of dullness and drowsiness. The next one, suppose a man were a slave, not self-dependent, but dependent on others, unable to go where he wants, but later on he would be released from slavery, self-dependent, independent of others. A man able to go where he wants, then on considering this, he would be glad and full of joy. Again, the idea of restlessness and craving being like being a slave. Restlessness and craving is in charge, and you are just the you have to suffer the consequence of having a slave driver driving you around. Or suppose a man with wealth and property were to enter a road across a desert, but later on he would cross over the desert safe and secure with no loss to his property. Then on considering this, he would be glad and full of joy. This is quite a beautiful simile of the idea of having doubt. You are in the desert, you have no teaching to guide you in your life, you live a material existence where all you look out for is the material goods in the world. And we know how empty such an existence can feel. And it feels especially empty when it goes wrong. You strive for the material things in the world and then you lose things, it disappears, which sooner or later it will have to do anyway. And then you start to question the meaning of life. Everything feels empty. It's like a desert, this empty feeling inside. You get so easily depressed when all you do is pursue material things of the world, because life seems so meaningless and pointless and joyless. The opposite is not being in the desert, is having some greater purpose in life, something that actually lifts you up and doesn't make you just dependent on the material things in the world. And then even if the material things in the world go wrong, you have something much deeper that is there. You have the goodness of your heart, you have the things that the mental the mind that you have developed over a long time, and that you can always bring with you into the future. Life is like an oasis instead of a desert. There is water there to drink when you feel thirsty. There's nice dates on the palm trees in the oasis. Isn't that right? Is it date palms? I think so. So in really nice sweet dates, and then you kind of, that is what life is like when you're out of the desert. And on each of these occasions, you are so glad and full of joy because you see the ending of these hindrances. So too, bhikkhus, when these five hindrances are abandoned in him, bhikkhu sees them respectively as a debt, a disease, a prison house, as slavery, as a road across a desert. So keep this in mind. This is what these five hindrances are like. But when these five hindrances are abandoned in him or in them, they see them as freedom from debt, healthiness, release from prison, freedom from slavery, and a land of safety. Okay, so there you are. That is the five hindrances for you. So that is all for now, and we'll see you back again at 7:30 this evening here.